This is a Cyber Union talk show for Thursday, March 1st, 2012. Left wing, floss, right wing, or what?
Hello and welcome to Cyber Unions. I'm Walton in Glasgow, Scotland, and with me, as always, is Stephen.
In Mexico City. How are you doing, Walton?
I'm doing pretty well. I've just got back from playing football. It's late at night here in Glasgow, so I had a very, very energetic game of football, and I'm exhausted. I'm either getting less and less fit, or the games are getting more and more intense, but I feel properly exercised, which is good.
Nice, nice. I got to say, it's nice to be in a country that football is actually referring to something that you kick something with instead of something that you run down the field with.
Brendan, there's excellent news from the UK, and that is that the Sparks have won their dispute. Now, back in episode 27, we spoke about electrical construction workers and other skilled workers on construction sites who were having their agreements torn up by seven major construction companies led by Balfour Beatty Engineering Services. The companies, in their own words, were trying to drag construction kicking and screaming into the 21st century, which is basically code for de-skilling and casualizing the workforce. And it would have resulted for a lot of people in pay cuts of sort of 30 to 35%. So, you know, massive undercutting of conditions in the sector, and essentially they're using the current recession and the austerity program as cover. They're being opportunistic and trying to get it through, and it collapsed. The dispute was thoroughly won by the union, and I think it's probably one of the most important trade union victories for a long time in the UK.
Now, you say thoroughly won, which is something that I don't usually see described with any union, because usually it's the union wins and you later see that there are some things that they had to give up. So how did they thoroughly win? What was their strategy?
Well, I think the reason it was so successful and what's so important about this dispute is that it was led by the rank and file. And for me, that's really important, because in my experience working with unions, a lot of people join the union and then kind of expect the union to fight their battles for them. And this was very much a case of the rank and file members decided they are absolutely not going to accept this new agreement called BESNA, and they hounded the companies and wouldn't leave them alone. The official union, the organization, did everything that it had to do. It balloted for industrial action. It publicized what they were doing. But essentially, the rank and file were in charge of their own struggle. And basically, what they did was picket everywhere. Whenever the construction industry had some kind of awards dinner, and there were several of them, they picketed outside the awards dinners. They picketed supermarkets, where there's a supermarket in the UK called Morrison's, which has ties, a maintenance contract with one of these companies. So they picketed the supermarkets on a Saturday morning when everyone's shopping, and they handed out flyers. They picketed big construction sites. There's basically something every week all across the country for about 6 months. The companies just got worn down by it. And then Unite balloted for official industrial action. The companies got last year a high court injunction to stop it. Unite balloted again. And just before the action was set to go ahead, they gave up. The companies, they've given up completely, and they've gone back to the old industry agreements that they also have. And interestingly, the collapse of this campaign by the companies came in the same week that the Teamsters in the US wrote a very strongly worded letter to Balfour Beatty saying that they took a very dim view of this kind of action, and they would be taking action in the US in solidarity. And apparently there were pickets outside US consulates in a number of US cities. So that was an interesting development, that people really appreciated the solidarity they got from the Teamsters.
Now, that's interesting. Now this is the same Teamsters that currently is head by Jimmy Hoffa, correct?
Jimmy Hoffa is actually the guy who wrote the letter to the head of Balfour Beatty saying...
In support, I just have to emphasize, in support of a rank-and-file movement, right?
Yes.
Okay, that's quite surprising to me, considering his background against and fighting off every election that he's had because of the rank-and-file movement within the Teamsters called Teamsters for Democratic Union. So that's quite interesting that he's taken this moment to support the rank-and-file, not in his country. Interesting. That's quite interesting, Walton. But that's great to hear that Sparks actually succeeded. I'm hoping that it was all their effort and very little by the Jimmy Hoffa.
Yeah, it's really good news, because it's very easy to be despondent at a time like this and think that we're all on, you know, the best we can do is manage decline and try to make things not quite as bad as it could possibly be. It shows you can actually still win victories. Now, all they've done is actually defend their existing contracts, but still it's a significant victory. And they've taken on major construction companies and won. I don't think they've let it get to their heads. I think they know that there's a hard battle ahead to preserve and also to improve conditions in the construction sector. It's a really important victory, and it's really heartening for other trade unions, especially since it's private sector. It's quite difficult sometimes to get these big private sector victories. So yeah, it was good. What's nice. Going on in your part of the world?
Well, I will say first, it's nice that we actually brought unions back into our discussion, because mostly we've been talking about free software. But mostly it's been going really well, actually. Last night, actually, I had a meeting, or not a meeting, I was in a meeting with an Occupy movement down here. And they started wanting to have a discussion about doing web security, because a lot of them are concerned about information being eventually subpoenaed by the government in lists of names of all activists and things like that. So it started with that discussion and ended with basically everybody there getting tails, which, if you remember from way back when, I can't remember what episode, we actually originally talked about the Torrent project, or the Tor project, with tails.
The Amnesiac Incognito Live System.
Yes, that would be the one. The Linux distribution that has amnesia and always forgets itself. Is how I always refer to it. But we had a really good discussion, and it's a really good group of people that actually have very little to no experience outside of Firefox within the free software world, and are really excited about learning some new projects and different ways that they can utilize it. And my colleague or member Enrique from May 1st was also at the meeting. We're discussing about some of the options with the May 1st servers, and things that they could take advantage of, and things that we plan to cover in future workshops, so they can learn and participate in the larger community. So we're eventually going to be doing GPG key signings, which is very nerdy in a lot of ways, but I've done it myself. So, you know, it's fun, it's cool, and you really understand the security that you gain with it when you attend a key signing event. Mm-hmm. But that'll be doing something that we'll be doing in the near future. But one of the things I emphasize with them is that they're concerned about the information getting out there about what they're sending, to make sure that they're using Tails on their computer when they're doing stuff related to it, and then just when they're doing their regular stuff with being in school or work or whatever, just to use their regular system that they usually use, so there's not a trace and not a trail for anybody to follow necessarily. So but yeah, it's really cool. It's starting to see some interconnections with other Occupies here, and a lot of discussion about free software, and I think it's a needed thing right now of them moving to a platform on the internet that's going to be developing a community as well, because neither of them have camps anymore, and they've been trying to figure out how to keep things exciting and energizing. And I've been showing them some of the things with Occupy Boston and things like that, that like the Occupy radio station that we have that's online, and they're pretty excited about trying to learn these things and taking the movement forward. So pretty cool. I got to say. So anything else in your world that's going on?
Yeah, just the other thing is that regular listeners will know that a couple of years ago I graduated from an MA program at Ruskin College in Oxford in International Labour and Trade Union Studies. And in a couple of days' time, I'm going down to speak to the current cohort of students about cyber unions. So
Nice.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that. I hope some of them end up listening to the podcast as a result. So if you are, hello, Ruskin students.
We're trying to get more listeners. I thought we were trying to get less listeners. Shit, I got it all wrong.
it's a really, really excellent MA program that they have. So I'm looking forward to meeting this group of students and seeing how they're getting on.
Actually, speaking of, if we're going to compete against MA programs, we should try to get a match between my MA program versus your MA program in football.
Yeah, well, that's a good idea, yeah.
We'll play American style. You guys play European style. We'll be fine. that sounds great, Walton.
So I see that you have been doing lots of stuff on the Cyber Union's website because it looks different. What's been going on there?
I've been learning a lot of things and having a lot of fun. And I've been not telling you because it's fun that way. So I wait till this moment to tell you. We have a forum section now.
Oh, awesome. Okay.
Which was a lot of fun to actually put together. I thought it was going to take a lot longer than it did. It took, I think, maybe 10 minutes.
Wow.
And it was much faster than I could even imagine. But what's cool is it's GPL forum software called Vanilla Forums, and I was familiar with it because I'd seen it once before, and I can't remember exactly the first place. It may have been one of the Linux distributions that I was participating in, and then I saw it again with Occupy, and I was like, oh, well, that'd be cool to put on the site. We need a place for people to be able to converse and different topics and different subheadings and like that. And so I decided to check it out. And Sunday, I just was planning on scheduling a day with one of the members from May 1st to help me out with it. And that schedule became an hour later. And then 20 minutes after that, boom, done. Mm. though it does not look CSS friendly. That's what I'm in the process of learning, is how to make it look very nice and playing with style sheets. So I'm in the process of learning both WordPress and CSS, but I hope you enjoy it. Does it look nice?
Yeah, it's good. It's a really useful addition to the site, and I hope that someone posts something in the forums.
Yes. Well, and right now, again, like the StatusNet site, it's invite only. But the cool thing is that both the StatusNet site, and this actually works for Identica too, is that your user account is an open ID. So you can use that to log into other places online where they have open ID as options, which are a lot of places. So if you're not wanting to use your Google open ID, because that's also an open ID, you could create an account on status.cyberunions.org, and then you could use that same open ID to log into the forums, which I activated too. So some pretty cool little integrations between things, so you don't have to keep creating new usernames and passwords.
Mm. Yeah, well, I hope the forums take off and we get some interesting discussions going over there.
Definitely.
Anything else?
No, that's basically it on the tech side. Okay. Though I was going to say, within the forums, since we're looking for debates, I think we had a bit of a debate and discussion in the emails, if you want to jump into a bit of a discussion about that.
Yeah, absolutely. The last show kicked off a bit of a discussion. You remember that you got a bit ranty about Michael Elbert and his Z Social.
Me? Thing. Ranty? What?
Yeah, and and you know, his whole thing about not liking the free software movement. Kevin, who we referred to last time, contacted us back and challenged our perspectives on Floss, on free Libre open source software. I guess the impression I got from his email was he felt that we were uncritically accepting that that Floss is left wing, and he was asking us, is it really? There are some really good left wing critiques saying that it isn't left wing, and I figured that's actually quite a good debate to have: is Floss left wing or right wing? And the reason it's an interesting thing is that when I first discovered free and open source software, my instinct was, this is left wing, this is, you know, some form of techno communism or whatever it is. And then I found kind of Austrian school economic right wingers who also like free and open source software. And I was like, what's going on here? Like, why do they like it? And I figured the reason, the appeal for them was that it gave tools to sort of entrepreneurs to tackle rent-seeking oligarchs like Bill Gates and so on. And I think that was why they felt it was useful. But it's quite interesting that people who are sort of economic libertarians are also completely comfortable with free and open source software. So what do you think? Is it left wing, right wing? Does it matter?
They actually raise a good point, because the I've seen that too. There tends to be, at least I've seen, I don't have numbers to back it up, but there tends to be a current of libertarians within the tech sector itself, which is quite interesting, and it kind of confuses me too, but your explanation makes sense. One of the things that was left over, I guess you could say, from the feudal system was the idea of rent, of ownership of land, which they didn't, at least from my understanding over the transition of feudalism to capitalism, we're supposed to get rid of ownership. Mm-hmm. And allow capital to grow wherever and just be able to freely go wherever. There's the theory, at least. So it does attract that, which is not uncommon, because I think of like the movements that are going on now with like Occupy, there tend to be some libertarians that go there and mm-hmm. They're challenging the system. So which, you know, in my mind doesn't mean that the Occupy movement is right wing or left wing, mm-hmm. but it can be utilized for either. And I think that's what the goal of Part of Free Software is it's political in the sense, in my mind, in the sense that it's putting it out there. It's putting stuff out there for anybody to use, which is not what capitalism necessarily is used to doing. But mm-hmm. it is something that capitalism can take advantage of, which I think is a key thing to keep in mind.
Yeah.
Go on.
I was just going to say, you know, for me, it's really helpful to make and to insist on the distinction between free software and open source. Because, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of people kind of automatically assume that it's the same thing. And we've said this before, but it's important to remember that open source is a production mechanism. It's and there are different reasons for that people use open source production, and might be ideological reasons because they believe in free software, but it might also be simply that a particular company is happy to donate the cognitive surplus of their employees against the will of their employees to something that gives them good PR or has some other good business reason. For example, hardware companies often support Floss because it means that there's software that will run on their machines. And I also suspect that a lot of the development happens in the public sector, for example, publicly funded universities where researchers and scientists are working on some of these projects. And then to make a distinction between that and free software, which is an ideological movement, which is not necessarily left-wing, but I think it's probably sits more comfortably on the left than on the right.
That's true. I think there are a couple of different things that I'm thinking right now, and one is that it's kind of like a union, that just by having a union doesn't mean that you're a lefty. There are plenty of union members that at least in the States I can account for, that will support conservative leadership and conservative politicians as well as conservative economic policies, but they're still members of a union, and it doesn't mean that the exploitation is gone and that the labor theory of value of where profit comes from is gone. It, mm-hmm. it doesn't. Mm-hmm. But it does mean that, you know, in the same sense that you can utilize free software to still make profits and still to exploit workers, and that's going to happen within this economic system. But it also means that, you know, for the good unions out there, as I like to separate them from the bad unions, is that if you are working towards making it horizontal and the workers taking over the workplace, then, you know, free software is in that same moment. It's in that same position of, if you use it in the right direction, in the right or the correct way, not saying the right way because right is the way we're trying not to go, is that you can make it utilized for building a different mode of production, whereas closed source, you have no access to anything. Mm-hmm. You'd have to be working for that company to get that information out in the first place. Mm-hmm. And it's, as we've seen, organizing in the tech sector is very, very hard. It's much more challenging than a lot of sectors because of the free mobility of putting workers or hiring workers around the world, and, you know, the threat of that, which is going to exist within the system. But it's just a matter that I think other those that want to build a better world have more tools through the free software movement and have an ideological perspective with it of we're making use of the commons to build something stronger for the commons itself and not for a corporation.
Absolutely. And in fact, that's where Kevin made another really important point. He's talking about the commons and then he says, but remember, this is an information only commons. You know, in other words, it's not that we hold all the land in the world in common or something. This is a commons which is existing in cyberspace and it's hosted on privately run servers. So there's a whole contradiction there. And that's true. But, you know, I was thinking about that and made me think it's kind of like a massive online sandbox where we can experience what a commons is like in a kind of digital post-scarcity world and what it's like to be able to sort of, you know, freely share information. And I think we can learn a lot from that, which we can then attempt to apply back to the physical world as well. And I think, you know, commons management is an important way to look at all the resources that we have. And, you know, if it works online, why can't we extend it to kind of common ownership of things in physical space as well?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. And I'm making a bit of a stretch on trying to bring this in, but it reminds me of, do you remember the car company Saturn?
Never heard of it.
Well, Saturn was a car company. Maybe it was just U.S. I think it probably was just in the U.S., but it was a car company with car brand within the General Motors company. And what I'm trying to go here is trying to explain like that it's a matter of yes, things are still within the capitalist system, which means it's still supporting the capitalist system, but it goes back to, I think many times I referred to dialectical materialism, is that we need to start building within this system what we're going to be replacing it with, because it doesn't just suddenly change. And one of the things that GM did, this was, I can't remember when, maybe in the 80s actually, or maybe the 90s, I can't remember exactly what the time period was, but they worked with United Auto Workers, their union, to develop the Saturn car and the car brand. And the way they did it was the workers actually had democratic power within the workplace on design and conditions of the workplace, which you never hear about in a capitalist structure because that's communism when the workers have a vote and have a decision like that. And I mean, I say communism with the sarcasm if you guys didn't hear that. but it was still within the company of GM, which is a capitalist company, and it was very successful, and the Saturn car sold very well, and it was not a very expensive vehicle, even though it was union made, which is the blame that car industries always give, is that the cost of union made products is a lot higher. But they did such a great job on the design and the involvement that GM was threatened by the power change, and they eliminated the whole program. They got rid of the worker involvement, and then literally with it went Saturn, which you don't hear about anymore because it doesn't exist anymore. go on.
No, sorry, I was just going to say, in. I mean, that clearly works. And even capitalists know that if you give people ownership and involvement over production, they put more into it. I think it's officially called high intensity working practices. That's the kind of management term, HIWP, where you give workers, you put workers in teams, you give the teams autonomy, and, you know, they kind of, peer pressure and a sense of pride and ownership takes over and people produce more. And it's probably a better experience for those people working because they feel more involved. However, the what Marx calls alienation of their labor is still taking place because once that product leaves their hands, once the car is made and driven out the factory, it doesn't belong to them anymore. And the surplus value is still going to the employer and they're just getting their regular wage. So and you know, I think there is. I think you're quite right to make an analogy with that and free and open source. You know, just because it involves people doesn't mean it necessarily liberates them, although it does create tools which we hope people can use.
Yeah, and I mean, another company that does this on a regular basis is Google. Like the whole 20% time that everybody thought was like, oh, this is great change of business structure and all this other stuff, but it's not really any major change. It's not like for those 20% time that they're not working for Google. Yes, they can work on their projects, but they're still employed by Google. But it also goes into this other thing of the exploitation still exists. And in a lot of cases, at least from the people that I've known who have worked for Google, they're on salary. But they're also working more than 40 hours a week, which means that they're I mean, even if you're working 40 hours a week, you're being exploited. But if you're working more than 40 hours a week, you're being heavily exploited.
Yeah.
And even if 20% of that time is on what you want, great. That's on what you want, but you're still being exploited. And it doesn't change the mode of production. And that's, I think that's the thing that gets lost in this whole criticism of free software is like, well, these modes of production still exist, like the capitalist structure. I'm like, well, yes, if you're going to go work for a company that has a boss, then yes, your mode of production does not change because you're using free software. But because it's free software, you could go and build a worker-run cooperative or collective that utilizes it and builds off of it, and you're not exploited, and you're not part of the capitalist structure.
It makes a different mode of production possible. It makes peer production possible. And I think that's potentially quite powerful, but it is still a potential. But it's an interesting debate. It sounds like we need to get hold of Kevin and put him on the show.
If he's willing to, that'd be great. It'd be a great discussion to have. I mean, there's so much more that I even want to bring up now, but I'm trying to hold myself back just in the interest of time of not going into a 2-hour show. There's a lot to cover in this topic, and I think it's a start of really, I want to say, a recurring series, which is ironic because it was kind of something that Kevin brought up about having more theoretical discussions, and I think we kind of did that and are starting that. So I'm going to hold myself back, Walton, because I could go on for a lot longer here.
Okay. I guess the only other thing I was going to say about it was that Floss isn't necessarily anti-capitalist. It can be used very effectively by anti-capitalists, but I think it is ultra-capitalist. In other words, it's also likely, even if it's subsumed completely into the capitalist system, it's likely to be a slightly different kind of capitalism that uses it. And I think that it's likely to be a capitalism of kind of smaller producers, you know, in the way the kind of right-wing economists who support it agree that it gives them kind of a bit of power against the Apples and the Microsofts of the world. And personally, I find that slightly progressive. You know, I'm not going to get excited about it, but I would rather have lots of small producers than a couple of really, really massive corporations that own and control everything. And, you know, as much as we dislike capitalism, some forms of it are better than others. Social democracy and neoliberalism are both forms of capitalism, but I strongly prefer social democracy. So, broadly, I think that there's something in free and open source software that is tending to take us to a better place. I'm positive about it. I think while it's not necessarily left-wing or even progressive, it's more progressive than copyright and proprietary software. And I think for me, the most crucial thing is giving tools to activists that they wouldn't have otherwise. Free and open source or free software you don't have to pay for, raises productivity because you're able to do things that you couldn't do before without having to buy software. And that can raise productivity for corporations, but it can also raise productivity for activist groups and trade unions. And I guess that's what we need to use it for.
Yeah. And I mean, it's given us the power to have now 37 episodes that wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for free software.
Yeah.
Or would have happened and would have cost us a lot of money and we probably would never have met. Well, actually, I haven't met yet, but I think that's a very good point. I think it goes back to what I was saying about unions, is that, you know, just by having a union doesn't mean that we've eliminated the problem within the workplace and that we've eliminated the conflict between a boss and a worker. It still exists as long as, you know, that enterprise still exists, and that if we don't move to the next stage of trying to take over that workplace and trying to make it a democratic workplace, then, you know, we're lost. And it's the same thing with free software. If we let the corporate capitalists take advantage of it to make their money, they can easily do it, and it could just say, oh, well, we're at least working with free software, you know, just like, oh, at least I'm buying a union-made thing. Well, great. I'd rather be buying a worker-made thing that's only by the worker that sees the surplus and decides what to do with it than a boss who does. So,
yeah.
It's the same. I didn't realize how well that analogy was going to actually work, so I'm glad it did.
Yeah, it would have been unfortunate if it had gone horribly wrong sort of in mid-sentence and we'd been left with dead air.
Oh, yeah. Although, I guess, does dead air exist on the internet?
I guess you just edited out, won't you?
Me? Edit out dead air? We've never had that happen before. Or edit out ums and ahs. Well, I will say that we are getting better at that. Anyhow, now we're getting off topic. I think this is something we definitely need to return to. Whether Kevin comes onto the show or if it's just a recurring theme of our series of podcasts.
Yeah, I hope you get some feedback on this. I want to know what people think. You know, are people kind of politically minded about philosophy, or are they just purely practical?
I always thought people didn't think. So you want people to think now?
Yeah, let's ask people to think.
I thought we were leaders, that we were trying to tell people how to think and make sure that they follow that and that they can't question us.
Okay.
I mean, people can send what they want, emails or whatnot, at mv@cyberunions.org or to our communities online. But, you know, if you're going to think, you might have a problem with that. All right, well, I hope we have listeners to listen to our show next week after this one. And otherwise, yeah.
Okay.
I'll see you all next week.
Yeah, thank you and good night.
I'll just do my little shindig. This is the Cyber Union Talk Show for Thursday, February 20... Oh, shit, that's not February. Hello. Let me try that again. oh, shit, actually, the other thing we're skipping over is Google's privacy thing changes.
Oh, nice, yes.
The day that we're going to be releasing this, so that just dawned on me. Okay, let me record this again.